Welcome to Still Untitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
We're sitting on a couch today in your office.
Yes.
Together. We're not facing the right direction. This is, in retrospect, maybe this was the wrong idea, but we'll figure it out as we go.
Everyone only gets to see the photos behind us. We've got my dad's portrait of Modigliani.
Okay.
No, my dad wasn't old enough to know Modigliani. It's a picture of Modigliani.
So it's a portrait of a picture. A
portrait of a picture.
Okay.
It's a picture of my wife in London, where she looks very fashionable.
It's a fantastic picture.
It's a picture of the this beautiful installation at LACMA in LA.
Okay.
And then...
is that one new? Or was that...
No, that's also pretty old.
Okay.
I have just been... We've been getting our photos and art in line here at the house. Pulling stuff out and having more stuff framed. Nothing's ever done.
When you do the pictures of the prints of the big pictures, do you print them yourself or do you send them out someplace?
No, I print them myself. I have a Canon PIXMA 9000.
Okay.
Which I picked up a few years ago on Craigslist for like $100 because the PIXMA 9000i or whatever the next one had just come out. And of course a full suite of ink for it is like $160.
Oh yeah. And it expires after X number of years. So you have to really burn through it.
I haven't burned through it, but actually I found that its ink stays pretty reasonable. Okay. I've had other printers where the stuff just dies on the vine, but this one, and the prints are gorgeous and archival.
Okay.
So both of those prints of my boys up there are on that, and they're gorgeous. I am about to add some UV protective coating to the windows here in the office.
Ah, yeah, you have good stuff in here. You don't want it to fade.
Yeah, especially the big dome on that thing, which we can't talk about.
The thing that we're never going to talk about?
I don't think so.
Maybe one day,
that
eventually.
Is so tantalizing.
It is like, I can't, it's not even right to talk about it. It's too good to talk about it and
awesome.
Not be able to, yeah. But you know, what we are going to talk to is spiritually connected.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. I thought we should talk about Blade Runner today.
I'm always game to talk about Blade Runner. So first we should say Norm is out.
Norm is out.
He's on assignment doing something much, much cooler than either of us are doing right now.
So freaking cool.
Yeah.
He's in Europe, right? That's where that shit is.
Yeah, so he's in Europe. I got an email from him this morning that sounded grumpier than normal. And I was like, oh, how was your flight? As a response, he was like, I didn't sleep the entire way. It's a 14-hour flight. And I was like, dude, did you not take the... Anyway, we talked about how to do this. Yeah.
Ambien.
But he apparently didn't...
Then you got no one to blame but yourself.
I think he was way in the back in the middle of the aisle, on the middle of the five seat. Like the nightmare seat by the bathroom that doesn't recline. Anyway.
That's pretty much the worst.
Mistakes were made.
Yeah.
But again, I feel no sympathy whatsoever. Just right. To be clear.
When everyone finds out what he's doing,
yeah.
I won't have his sympathy either.
Yeah. Well, there's two parts. There's one part that's less cool, and then there's one part that's like, wow, yeah. Super jealous.
Traveling with Joey, that's less cool.
Joey's great. Joey's one of my all-time favorite traveling companions.
I would imagine he is relatively unflappable.
He is the guy that, like... He's the one that always texts you when you're in the hotel and you've been in the hotel for like 30 minutes. He's like, hey, I'm going to go to the bar down the street. You want to come get a beer? And it's great because it's like, he literally means let's go have a beer or two, maybe have a hamburger or something and have a kind of low-key.
Get the hell out and go to sleep.
Right. Doesn't want to go out and throw down.
that's nice. Yeah.
No, it's good. He's a pro.
I almost never leave my hotel room now when I go on location.
But when you guys go to the desert, a lot of times you go someplace, places that there's nothing to do. Yeah.
Well, even then, even when there's places where there's stuff to do or nothing to do, I tend to relish. In my daily existence, I'm never alone.
Yeah.
And it's really quite nice to find some super downtime. And I'll take it and use it with great abandon.
The quiet time to yourself is...
The quiet reflective time.
Yes.
For meditation. But yeah, I wanted to talk about... I thought... We've been talking about special effects movies, and I've actually been talking to some of the guys from my favorite magazine in the world, my favorite special effects magazine ever, Cinefex.
Yeah, they're great.
And the image that a lot of people have of Cinefex is, I think they're like issue number 7, which is this beautiful shot of a Blade Runner spinner, and it's most of the issues about Blade Runner.
The spinner is the car, the flying car, right?
The floating police vehicle. And... Blade Runner ends up becoming like this touchstone. Like, you don't even have to like the plot to appreciate how it has a Citizen Kane level of importance on science fiction films.
Yeah.
And you know, I worked on AI. I got to work on AI, and I had actually been following AI since the early 90s. I had heard the first rumors that Kubrick was working on another science fiction film.
And it came out in what, like 96?
No. AI is like 2001.
Oh, really?
So, yeah.
Okay.
So it was after he died.
I watched it. It was a DVD, yeah.
Right. So after he died, his family passed all of his material and sketches and script onto Spielberg to direct it. And so it was unbelievable to me to actually get to work on this film I've been following. I thought we were working on another Blade Runner. And my team and I at Industrial Light and Magic, our job was to take the buildings for New York and make them look like they'd been immersed in water for 50 years to do all the damaged and destroyed buildings in New York. I've rarely had so much fun.
That seems like that's got to be right up there with like blowing up the White House in Independence Day.
It really was. I was casting beams out of weakened plaster with plant wire in it so that when you broke them, you saw rebar.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, this one team, I think my friend Aaron Hay was in charge of that team making the buildings, and then they'd give them to me, and my job with my team was to destroy them. Like snap them in half. Well,
weathering had to be. It like, was super exciting.
It was
you.
Months,
yeah.
And there's a building down right at the Powell Street exit off of 80, heading towards the Golden Gate Bridge, heading towards the Bay Bridge. Excuse me, that was being built at the time. So I was using as reference all of these images from the Kobe earthquake of buildings that had fallen over and snapped in half, literally just unbelievable stuff. And then I was also watching this building being built, commuting every day. And we all thought we were working on another Blade Runner.
So I saw that movie and I remember being unimpressed with it at the time. Have you watched it recently? Has it aged well?
I have heard, and I haven't gone and tested this, I have actually heard that AI weathers incredibly well.
I don't remember. It isn't a movie that I remember for the effects.
Right. Well,
which is probably a good sign.
Yeah, that is probably a good sign. So what I've heard, I've been reading some recent defenses of AI as a really important and terrific movie, that the themes are really impressive and exciting. I have my problems with its pacing and the level of involvement I felt with the characters, but it has some really transformatively difficult moments. Like when you ask your toy, what should we do? And your toy says run. That is messed up. Like I was thinking, good God, that's so beautiful. A script that gets you to a point where you say to your toy, what do we do? And your toy says, now we run.
Yeah. That's it's great.
Amazing.
Yeah.
But when it first came out, I went and saw it and I called up my best friend, David. And I said, what'd you think? And he's like, ah, everyone should hide their head in the sands. No one's made a movie that looks as good as Blade Runner. And it's been 20 years. I was like, wow, he's totally right. He's actually completely right. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about some of those factors because it's hard to, you know, a film can go right or wrong for a million reasons. And it's not necessarily true that any one person or any group of people can control whether it goes north or south.
It's like, unlike music and novels and anything else other than video games, really. Like, nobody sets out to make a bad movie. Nobody sets out to make a bad video. Well, okay. Very few people set out to make bad movies. Yes. They run them on the science fiction channel, sci-fi, sorry. and they're intentionally bad.
Yeah.
But yeah, you don't set out to make Prometheus suck, or you don't set out to make AI bad.
Right.
And there's hundreds of people working on it.
But there's a way in which Blade Runner was made that shockingly very few other movies were made in this way. So in order to start this discussion, I wanted to define a few terms. When we see movies and we see an effect like somebody running against a field of giant futuristic buildings, or you look at a cityscape, right? That can be generated in one of a whole number of ways. In the old days, they could build a scale model. Mm-hmm. They could paint a matte painting, which means they actually paint a cityscape on glass and film it with a movie camera, sometimes cutting out a portion of the glass and putting people behind it. But because you've exposed the light, it actually looks like the cityscape's behind the people.
And sometimes they even do like perspective paintings on the glass because they'll know which angle the shot's going to be from and stuff
absolutely,
like that. Right?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, they'll even look at a cityscape. They'll look at a street they're going to film from an angle and cut out exactly that street's worth of the angle from the glass so that they can mat these two things together.
That's crazy.
So those two methods, in-camera effect and a glass mat, both of those methods involve filming the city directly. And in the case of the glass mat, it involves filming the city and the people behind it, sorry, the people in it directly. There's a great example of a glass mat in one of the master shots of Rome from Spartacus.
Okay.
And I'm thinking about this because I just went and saw the Stanley Kubrick exhibit at LACMA. And if you get a chance to see the Stanley Kubrick exhibit, it's unbelievable.
But the LACMA is the
LA County Museum of Art.
Okay.
And it's all his films. We spent 2.5 hours there. I bought the book. It's amazing. So there's this lovely mat of Rome, and you can see that they've cut out this portion of a city square. And so they put the glass mat close to the camera, but they're filming through the hole in the glass to the city square where they've got a bunch of extras. And when they expose that film, it looks like those people are in ancient Rome.
And it looks like a high shot. That's crazy.
So understand that all of the elements of that special effects shot are being exposed on the same piece of film. Right?
Okay. Yeah. There's no compositing. There's no matting. Right. Scanning the film in and putting a bunch of other stuff in.
Let's talk about what that is, right? Yeah. So the other way to do it is to film people against blue screen or green screen or even against black, but filming against something you can key them out against,
right,
which means you can basically use a process to mat in a background behind them that you shoot separately.
Right, and that is a technology that has gotten cheap to the point that iMovie includes it at this point.
Right, and yeah. It's called compositing. Now, the problem with compositing is that because you've exposed the film once and then you're either projecting it or reburning it onto the already exposed blue screen, you end up with a generational loss. You often end up with a generational loss that the audience can kind of see. And for a good example of a composite that is very exciting but still doesn't quite perfectly work, think about Bishop running from the exploding landing craft in Aliens. You can see that he's in front of a screen that they're projecting the thing on, and it doesn't quite match. His Christmas doesn't match the projection.
Well, and the other thing that happens is you see slight changes in things like lighting and shadows that you don't maybe consciously notice,
right,
but your brain looks at that and says, oh, it's fake. It's the same way that in the old days when they'd shoot a car driving scene, and instead of taking a car on the road, mounting a camera on the hood of the car and driving down the street, they'd just project the video or the film of a car.
Precisely. You see all those people in the old movies driving and the projection behind them.
Right. The wheel's turning one way and the car's going the other. And the whole thing's
off. That's a rear projection. And that's that also has a generational loss because it's not as crisp. It can never be as crisp because you're looking through a screen.
Right.
Stanley Kubrick actually solved that with front projection on 2001, but that's a whole nother story about how brilliant that process is. And really, we should spend some time talking about it because it's amazing. Suffice to say, all of the shots of the ape men in 2001 were shot on a soundstage.
But didn't he just build the frames out, the rocks up around the ape men so you couldn't see the walls of the soundstage?
Yeah, but okay. And he front projected the African veldt. He front projected instead of rear projected against 3M scotch light material. So the bounce back light was 300 times brighter.
Oh, so it's like a license plate.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Neat.
So, sorry, to get back to our terms, in-camera effects like a glass mat or a model shot, mm-hmm. composite shots where you do a blue screen and you later add in your background or your foreground.
And we've had blue screen stuff since the 70s,
absolutely,
pretty much, right?
For longer than that. And Star Wars made extensive use of blue screen for the spaceship stuff. And the thing is that it's just a fact that if you can expose everything at once in camera, it's going to look better. It's really going to look better. It's going to look deeper. It's going to look crisper. It's going to have more texture to it. And Blade Runner is one of the very few science fiction films in which almost all of the shots in Blade Runner are in-camera effects.
Really?
Yeah.
Even like the giant moving billboards projected on the sides of the models? The model LA?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. So let me explain how these were done. So if you take an average cityscape, like the blimp heading over the cities, you're looking up through buildings, you see the blimp, you see the screen on the blimp. So there's a bazillion elements going on, and they don't expose them all at once. Especially since the blimp is going to be on rods, on movers,
right?
That moves it through the frame. So these shots are filmed with what's called a motion control rig. It's effectively a robot with a film camera attached to it.
This is the thing that they invented for Star Wars, basically.
Yes, yeah. John Dykstra is one of the people that developed it, and Lucasfilm brought that to a completely high art form. And it's a robot with a camera strapped to it that effectively can repeat its moves perfectly every single time. So they would plot out a camera shot like the camera's moving slightly, looking up at buildings, and you see the blimp also moving across the skyscape. So what they would do is they would set up the shot so the blimp move across, and the blimp's moving and the camera's taking its shots one at a time.
Very slowly.
Very slowly.
1/24th the speed.
Actually, even probably slower to expose for the low light situation that you're in. It's nighttime. You probably could do longer exposures. It's a luxury you can have with a motion control rig that you don't have with a normal film camera. You can open up that frame as long as you want.
Right.
So they will do an exposure for the blimp and the buildings and the camera movement. And they'll just do an exposure for, let's say, the glow coming up from the streets.
Okay, so then they rewind the film.
Then they rewind the film and put the robot back to zero, and then they turn on all the little blinky lights on the blimp, and they pass it again. Now, recognize they're actually re-exposing the blinky lights right onto the same piece of film that they exposed the blimp and the cityscape on, so that it's just matting directly on top of the same piece of film.
So instead of taking multiple pieces of film and mashing them together in post...
You're doing what's called in-camera compositing.
So... I assume no one else does this because it's really tedious and took a long time.
It's incredibly tedious and incredibly expensive, and it took months and months and months and months. But in Blade Runner, most of those cityscape shots were between something like 15 and 20 in-camera passes.
Jesus.
Where each move might take 4 or 5 hours to complete, and they're rewinding it 20 times to expose for the rain and expose for the blinky lights on the spinner and expose for the reflective lights and expose for Harrison Ford and Edward James Olmos in the cockpit. And then they expose for the smoke. And then they expose for the building lights. And then they expose for the sunlight.
So it's like multiple rendering passes in a video game. It's
exactly.
Literally like, yeah, I mean, it's the same thing. It's just...
And I submit, if you look at, Cinefex did a questionnaire years ago, and I think that the shot of the police spinner turning clockwise as the camera's turning counterclockwise as the spinner is landing on the roof of the Los Angeles Police Department is considered one of the like two or three most beautiful effect sequences in all of film, and I totally agree.
After we started working with you last year and we started talking about Blade Runner again, I hadn't watched the movie since it probably came out on DVD 10 years ago. And I went back and I got the Blu-ray and I sat down and I just watched the DVD. It doesn't matter. The upshot is I sat down and watched the movie again for the first time since I was probably 25 or 26. And the effects in that movie hold up in a level at which nothing other than maybe Aliens and Alien and Star Wars from that era.
Yeah.
It is aged better than anything that happened between the mid 80s and let's say, post Jurassic Park, maybe.
It's shocking. It's shocking how beautiful the film is. And to give you another example of in-camera effects versus composites, I will point you to another movie that came out close to that time, I think in 85, 86, a pair of movies, Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
And Batman.
Oh, Batman was in camera as well?
No. Oh. Batman was all composites.
It was all mats and composites.
Brazil is almost all models and all in-camera effects. Again, forced perspective, where you've got a model really close to the guy, mm-hmm. and you're changing people's perspective. When Jonathan Pryce is... This is great. When Jonathan Pryce is flying in the beginning of Brazil... That is not animation.
Really?
Really. What they did was they took a puppet that was about this long,
uh-huh.
and they put a motor in it so the wings flapped. They made them flap really fast, like, and then they made his arms out of lead so the wings had to actually
fight against
the weight of the arms. And then they overcranked the camera so that
Oh, okay.
It
so
it looked like a person so they, was really struggling against the wings to flap.
Wow! And then they just put the wings on the top on his back.
Yeah. And then they threw it on wires through past the camera.
Huh.
And the difference between Brazil and Batman is really marked. I think that Brazil is an almost perfect movie. I think from an effects standpoint, it is a perfect movie.
Now, I have deep love for Batman. And I know you don't.
I really don't.
I know.
I really don't. When the Joker pulls out that dumb gun.
The pants gun?
That is such a good joke. The stupidest gun in all of movies.
I saw this movie when I was 13, 14.
You know, it's funny. I just unloaded, right? Stupidest gun. And I'm thinking to myself, you're telling me about the comments getting negative, and I was thinking, we need Will Wheaton's axiom.
Don't be a dick.
Don't be a dick.
Yeah.
Like, just ask yourself when you're making a comedy, you're being a dick. So me saying it's the stupidest gun in all of movie history is a little bit dickish.
There's much stupider guns.
Oh, yeah, there are.
I mean, some people would say that, like, for example, the Hellboy gun.
Oh.
I mean, I'm not taking cheap shots here. But
no,
it's a ridiculously oversized firearm.
It is, but not for Hellboy.
Maybe Hellboy's ridiculously oversized. I love Hellboy. I can't talk about
I can't accept that there's any parity. Somewhere someone might think that. I submit that they might be wrong.
He shoots down the Batwing with that gun.
With that little tiny gun.
But he's the Joker. It's what he should do.
Feh. It plays for step. I never wanted slapstick out of Batman.
But Batman never plays slapstick. It's the stuff around Batman is the object of the slapstick.
Yeah, see, but it's the movie. Yeah.
So you like the Nolan Batman movies.
Like the Nolan Batman movies much better.
So I also think
the second Batman movie, Batman
one is
Returns,
my favorite.
Is fantastic.
Yeah, it's absolutely. I mean, it has
Danny
too many
DeVito's
people.
One of the best Batman villains
the
ever.
The flippers are really disturbing. Ugh. Still. Well, and it has a little more, like, there's a lot, anyway, loss and tragedy. We're talking about Blade Runner.
We should. So Blade Runner, I exhort you out there.
On the internet.
To look up the original Cinefex issue of Blade Runner. If you don't know about Cinefex, Cinefex, it comes out quarterly and it has since 1980, I believe.
It's the publication of record for the effects industry, basically,
yeah.
Right?
And if you want a PhD in 20th century film special effects, just read all 137 issues of Cinefex and you will have it. I've read them all. I love them. It's a great magazine. It was one of my sad, I've done okay, so don't have to feel sorry for me, but I was a little sad that I finished my tenure at Industrial Light and Magic and I had never gotten my picture in Cinefex.
Well, you know, there's still time.
There is time for them some romantic compendium looking back at AI and maybe I'll show up.
Right. The door at the end of Matrix Revolutions.
But the issue about Blade Runner goes into incredible detail about the process of the in-camera effects. And when you look at it, the proof is in the pudding. There's just nothing that quite looks that fantastic.
Was this something that clearly people had been doing in-camera effects with multiple exposures for a long time.
Absolutely.
But I assume that the motion control camera was the thing that came along that made the multiple, doing more than one or two layers possible.
Indeed. Before that, sometimes they would do multiple exposures where they would have half of the frame matted out black and they'd shoot on sticks and then they would carefully take the camera and move it to another location using a guide piece of film as reference to their mat and then re-expose on that film.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. In fact, actually, you know who else did a bunch of in-camera matting is Ray Harryhausen.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Some of his, I believe that large portions of the skeleton fight are exposed right alongside the guys fighting the skeletons.
Well, I mean, that makes sense because with animation, you have fine control over the camera, control over the models.
Right.
And since he did most of that stuff himself, as I understand it, which is insane. In addition to inventing it himself,
John Landis and I did an interview
you can find it on the site. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, I mean, John does not overstate it when he says that Ray Harryhausen is perhaps the most important influence on film.
His
stuff is just incredible, and all the different processes he invented, and Blade Runner makes some use of those. And it's amazing to me that it uses some techniques that are absolutely ancient with some of the most modern equipment, and we are now 33 years later.
Mm-hmm.
Is that really true?
From Blade Runner was 81? Yeah, 33. Yeah, it sneaks up on you, huh?
My God.
It's the 35th anniversary of Star Wars this year.
Right, right.
Think about that for a minute. Or 36, sorry. 35th was last year.
Cray, cray. Yeah, you know, and it's still not only does it hold up, it's an exemplary example of film special effects. Still, it is something to be compared.
It has stood the test of time.
Yeah.
So I guess that'll do it for us.
That is my pan to Blade Runner.
You know, at some point, what we should do, the thing where you say, okay, at the start of the film, here's the point.
Oh yeah, we'll do a commentary.
We'll sit down and watch the movie, do the commentary, and then just post the commentary and tell people to sync it up.
That is great. I would love to do that.
We could do that for that 2001. I think there's a lot of interesting stuff, and maybe get guests.
Oh yeah,
and
2001
stuff like that
would be amazing.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what we can do and make sure we're not going to get sued. Thank you as always, Adam.
Thank you, Will.
We appreciate feedback, comments, likes, dislikes, whatever you want to do. It doesn't matter.
But don't be a dick.
Try not to be
a dick. Just ask yourself if you're being a dick and then don't do that.
I like to think, am I contributing to entropy or am I fighting entropy?
Yeah, but I mean, there's some people who literally think that and go, Mom, I'm adding entropy. That's what I want to do. If you're doing that, you're a dick.
Yeah, basically, like,
they see
Heath
me
Ledger's
trolling,
Joker.
I be hating.
That's it. Yeah. don't be trolling. We'll see you guys next week.
Bye, guys. Bye.